Welcome back. This is the fourth audio file in the lecture on the National Historic Preservation Act. In this section of the lecture, we're going to talk about how Section 106 really works in practice. Remember, I've said that Section 106 is the most important part of the law for practicing archaeologists because it's the compliance with that section, even though it's very short, it's only 54 words long, compliance with that section is what actually generates the vast majority of archaeological work that is performed in this country. So how does that happen? Well, Section 106 is associated with a large set of regulations issued by the Advisory Council at 36 CFR Part 800. I've asked you to look at them. They're very long. They're somewhat confusing, I think. But what they do is they lay out a process of consultation between the federal agency, which is the entity that has to comply with Section 106, and the state historic preservation officer, the tribal historic preservation officer, local governments, applicants, and other interested parties like landowners and the public. So basically, the regulations require that the federal agency take into account the effects of its undertaking on historic properties by consulting with these organizations. Now, the consultation procedure is a multi-step, somewhat complicated process. There are flowcharts available online, and I've given you a link to one of them on the syllabus that sort of lay out the procedure that you follow. But basically, first of all, when a federal agency decides to do something, and believe me, federal agencies carry out many thousands of activities every year. Just a single military base or national park carries out hundreds or thousands of undertakings every year, right? They move this, they dig a hole, they dig a trench, they pave a road, put in an outhouse, build a dock. I mean, they're constantly doing something. I mean, how do you think we spend, $3 billion a day as a government? Well, I mean, a lot of it goes to salaries, and then the salaries are paying people to dream up this stuff, right? So we're always doing stuff. The government is always doing stuff. And so every time there's an undertaking, which is to say when an engineer or a planner gets a gleam in his or her eye, somebody at that federal agency, usually in the planning department, has to determine whether this meets the criterion for an undertaking. We've discussed what an undertaking is, what the definition is. Well, before a federal agency actually does something, actually expends money on something, they have to determine whether it is an undertaking. If it is an undertaking, then the federal agency official has to define what's called the area of potential effect of the undertaking. And obviously, as the name implies, that's the area that's going to be affected by it. But it's not necessarily that easy to define because, in some cases, it's just the construction footprint. But in many cases, it's more elaborate than that. I mean, if you're building a natural gas pipeline and you're a private corporation, you have to get a license from the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. And as part of the process, you have to go through Section 106. And that requires you to define the area of potential effect. So what's the area of potential effect for a 100-mile-long natural gas pipeline? Well, obviously, you're going to clear a right-of-way and you're going to dig a trench and bury the pipe. Well, that's part of the area of potential effect. But there are also pumping stations and there are access roads. And then, when it gets to the end, this big pipeline splits up into a bunch of smaller branches that eventually split into smaller branches. And those branches actually end up going into every house. So, does the area of potential effect include that, half-inch pipe that goes into my house? Actually, it probably doesn't, but it does cascade down the line to a certain point. I think where ownership or responsibility for the pipe ends. If you're building a dam and that dam will create a reservoir The area of potential effect is not just where the dam is built, it's also the area that the reservoir is going to flood, and then the area above the waterline where it's going to cause erosion from waves. So defining areas of potential effect is complicated, or can be complicated. And federal agencies often want to minimize the APE, and archaeologists and other professionals and the states, you know, want a realistic and fair definition of the APE. And sometimes there are conflicts over those. Once the APE has been defined, the federal agency has to determine whether historic properties are present. And that involves two key steps. Those steps are called identification and evaluation. When I say historic properties, I mean properties that are eligible for or listed on the National Register. And so how do you determine that? Well, you have to go out and look. Identification is the process of looking. And, you know, for archaeological sites, that means conducting an archaeological survey. But just finding sites doesn't allow you, in and of itself, to determine whether those qualify as historic properties that are eligible for listing on the National Register of Historic Places. In order to determine that, they need to be evaluated. And they need to be evaluated specifically to determine whether they meet the National Register criteria. And in many cases, for many archaeological sites, that requires a more detailed investigation of the site to determine whether they have integrity and whether they have or are likely to have information important in American history or prehistory, right? And as well as the possibility of that they may meet one of the other criteria A through C. So those are two key steps, identification and evaluation. The federal agency is normally expected to consult with its consulting partners, including the SHPO and the TIPO and other interested parties, about how they carry those steps out. If they don't consult and they do the identification and evaluation themselves and then share that information with their consulting parties, and the consulting parties are dissatisfied with those, with the steps they took to carry those procedures out, you may end up in a stalemate. The federal agency might, in theory, have to go back and do it again and do it better. So usually the federal agency consults with the with its consulting parties about how to do these things. In other words, what methods they're going to use. And states, as well as tribal historic preservation offices, have standard expectations for how these activities will be carried out. And one reason, in theory, why the federal law requires federal agencies to consult with local entities, like state governments, is that those entities are considered to be, or thought to be, the experts on the local archaeology and history. And indeed, in many cases, they are. And that's why they have created standards for survey and reporting and evaluation that they attempt to force federal agencies to comply with. Now, they don't actually have the power to require federal agencies to do things in the way that they wish, but they do have influence on the process, and they are often successful. You know, a lot of the state and tribal survey and evaluation standards are reasonable and common sense procedures that any archaeologist is, ought to be carrying out anyway. And so actually, and this is an important fact, the standard for survey is, well, I'm supposed to get to this later, but I'll just say it briefly now, is that they may have to make a reasonable and good faith effort to find archaeological sites and evaluate them. And we'll talk about what that means in a minute. So we've determined that an undertaking exists. We've defined the area of potential effect, or the federal agency has. Then the federal agency has to consult And they actually should consult about the area of potential effect as well, and the procedures used in identification and evaluation. And then, knowing what sites are there and whether or not they're significant, the federal agency can determine whether those historic properties, if any, will be adversely affected by the undertaking. If they are, or if they seem to be threatened, then they have to consult about how the undertaking can be modified to avoid the adverse effect. If the adverse effect can't be avoided, can it in some respects be mitigated? Right? Can you compensate for it in some way? So if the undertaking can be modified, then it usually implies that, you know, you cancel the project, or you move it, or you change it in some way so that it doesn't have this adverse effect. If that can't be done, then mitigation may be carried out. And for archaeological sites, mitigation is usually through more extensive excavations of the site to recover or collect a significant and hopefully representative body of data from the site. The process of consultation, which is all that Section 106 requires, should be going on throughout all of these steps, right? The definition of the APE and the procedures used in the survey and the evaluation of sites and whether or not the undertaking can be modified and whether mitigation takes place, right? That's the consultation process that is essentially at the heart of the Section 106 process. The consultation, and therefore the compliance with Section 106, is documented legally by the production of a memorandum of agreement. So whether or not there are any archaeological sites or whether they're significant or whether, you know, whatever happens, ultimately the Section 106 process is documented legally by everybody signing an agreement saying, this is what we did and this is what we agree to. And if the consultation parties are unwilling to agree on a memorandum of agreement, then the advisory council may get involved and try to resolve the conflict. If the federal agency cannot get people to go along with it, they can always proceed with the project, provided they go through the steps that are specified in the regulations to proceed, which is actually a process called termination of consultation. But one way or another, they can always move forward. So it's during the steps that we call identification and evaluation, as well as mitigation of adverse impacts, that generates most of the contract archaeology that public archaeologists do in this country. And that's why it's important to understand what these steps are and who's involved and how they're carried out. If an agency doesn't comply with the National Historic Preservation Act, in other words, if they don't follow the procedure, for example, they don't consult with the right parties, the advisory council will send them a letter indicating that they've broken the law because they have, and this is the terminology that's used, they have foreclosed the advisory council's opportunity to comment. The advisory council can't really do anything else. They don't have the authority to assess penalties against other federal agencies. But if the advisory council says that an agency has basically broken the law, then the agency can be sued by almost anybody. And they'll lose because, you know, the government itself has said that they haven't fulfilled their responsibilities. This is not surprisingly happened a bunch of times. And therefore, there is a bunch of Section 106 case law. You can read a summary of it in a day, and it's available online. And I think I posted a copy. The very complicated regulations at 36 CFR 800 have been upheld by federal courts. And they've, you know, the advisory council itself has been sued more than once, if I'm not mistaken, about whether or not its regulations are legal. and they have they've been upheld by the federal courts. Now, I just want to talk about some important details here, right? About sort of how Section 106 really works in practice, right? Most federal agencies, especially those federal agencies that routinely comply with a lot of Section 106 undertakings, they have their own written internal policies that specify how they do this. And those policies usually assign certain individuals holding certain positions in the agency to carry out certain parts of the process. So they specify who is the federal preservation officer, and maybe they define regional preservation officers, or at any rate, they specify who has the responsibility for carrying out these various steps and how it actually gets done. Now, these are not actually federal regulations. These are regulations that are internal to the agency and are promulgated for the smooth and consistent operation of the agency's internal processes. It's important for everybody involved to know what those are, because if you're, you know, a contractor and you've been hired by an agency, you know, the person you need to call to find out what to do or what the APE is or something like that, that's specified in those internal regulations. And so, it's worthwhile becoming familiar with those kind of documents. They're not usually available in the Federal Register itself. They have to be found on the agency's websites. Another practical issue is that SHPOs and TPOs are both political appointees. Remember, SHPOs are appointed by governments. TPOs are appointed by tribal governments. SHPOs are appointed by governors. And, you know, the political policies of the state or the tribe have an effect on how they negotiate things. So, not surprisingly, perhaps, far right-wing states, are uninterested in government regulation, which they see as interfering with either good government or with economic progress. They tell the SHPOs, don't do anything. Let the federal government and corporations do whatever they want. In cases like that, the SHPO has a very hard time protecting the archaeological sites and historic monuments of the state because they've been told by the governor to, like, not do anything, not object. In addition, some federal agencies just don't do a very good job of complying with Section 106. Some agencies do a good job. Some agencies very faithfully carry out their responsibilities. Other agencies don't. Since Section 106 only applies to agencies, if the agencies aren't complying with it, you know, there aren't a lot of remedies except suing the federal government, which is difficult to do. But if the state isn't doing anything, there are very few remedies for that as well. But, you know, the system works to some extent, although I think most practicing preservationists, including archaeologists, wish the law had more teeth and was more meticulously complied with. So, again, practically what happens is when a federal agency decides there's an undertaking, they send a letter to the SHPO and or the TPO and possibly other interested parties outlining the project. Usually they include blueprints or maps in which they show the area of potential effect, and they outline their plans for complying with Section 106, particularly the survey, that is to say, identification and evaluation parts. Agencies are supposed to consult about these things, and the way they consult is they document their consultation by writing to, you know, interested parties and proposing to do stuff in a certain way. If people object, then you can discuss it. In practice, if there's no objection or, you know, whatever the procedures that have been worked out in consultation, the agency or sometimes a private individual or corporation who is acting on behalf of the agency hires contractors, including archaeologists, to perform the survey and evaluation of sites. The archaeologist conducts an appropriate survey, hopefully, Sites that seem to be potentially significant are then evaluated specifically for their eligibility to the National Register. There is a literature on how this should be done. And then the federal agency and its consulting partners decide whether or not they need to modify their undertaking in any way. If there are adverse effects to significant sites that are eligible for listing on the National Register, then either the undertaking gets modified or perhaps data recovery excavations might take place to at least preserve some of the information about the site. And there's guidance published by the Advisory Council on Historic Preservation about how to do these things. Now, just one last point. How do you perform identification? Well, as I said before, the legal standard is you make a reasonable and good faith effort to identify sites. That doesn't mean you have to find every site. It means you have to make a reasonable and good faith effort. Now, what is a reasonable and good faith effort? A reasonable good faith effort includes using methods and techniques that are recognized in the scientific and archaeological communities as being appropriate. The states have promulgated methods which they think are reasonable. There is an archaeological literature on what is reasonable. There is precedence. You know, what has everybody else done? Standards may evolve, but, you know, if other people are all doing something, that may contribute to its reasonableness. There are legal definitions of what reasonable and good faith mean. But you can help defend your actions by using standard techniques or widely accepted techniques, techniques that are either required or preferred by state agencies or other federal agencies. And so, we'll talk in practical terms about what that means. But usually it means doing what the state asks or expects. And the state has a pretty good idea about how archaeologists do archaeology in their state. Now, how do you evaluate a site? In other words, what makes something significant in American history or prehistory? Well, you know, that is somewhat subjective. And therefore, the way it's done is through the use of what are called historic contexts. And historic contexts are narratives about what important processes and themes are in American history and prehistory. And they provide, as the name suggests, a context in which you can evaluate the historical or archaeological significance of different kinds of sites and structures and buildings and objects, right? Now, states develop historic contexts that they think are relevant to their states. Federal agencies develop historic contexts. And archaeologists and consultants develop historic contexts that attempt to explain or justify why things that they have found are important. States are supposed to outline historic contexts in their comprehensive historic preservation plans, and they're supposed to update them every 5 years. Some state plans are better than others, and some state plans are more up to date than others. And you should look at Florida's. In the next audio file, I will provide a few concluding remarks about Section 106 and the National Historic Preservation Act.